Pulse ingredients are looked at like beneficial ingredients in human nutrition and in pet food. So they are low in fat and high in fiber. So a lot of people see them as beneficial for promoting satiety. They're used in weight loss diets. They have a low glycemic index, so they help regulate. They help with diets to help with diabetes, and they have a good protein profile for a plant protein. So they're often used in plant-based diets as a protein source, and then kind of moving into this field in pet nutrition, they're also used as carbohydrate sources in grain-free diets as well.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Corbion's Alga Prime DHA P3, the algae-based omega-3 DHA to boost brain cognition, immune system, and well-being. Adding it to pet food is easier than ever. Biorigin, your partner in yeast ingredients for palatability, immunity, and nutrition. Complete solutions for every pet diet. Learn about the benefits of working with Schooler. Visit schooler.com/pet. That's schooler.com/pet. Young Generation Oral and Gut Health Solutions with antibodies from egg yolk. IGY Technology. Research driven, pet approved.
Hello and welcome to the Pet Food Science Podcast brought to you by Wisenetics. My name is Jan Sugodolski. I'm here professor at Texas A&M University. And I'm trying to bring you the latest insights and discussions into the pet food science industry. So hopefully you're ready to expand your knowledge. And it's my great pleasure to welcome today Pavan Singh. Pavan is a PhD candidate, she just told me, so in nutrition at the University of Guelph. And her project is mostly about pulse. Pulse is a food ingredients. Hi, Pavan. Nice to meet you.
Nice to be here today. I'm really excited.
Great. So what I like to do is usually ask our guests to introduce themselves a little bit. What was your career path? Where did you start? How was your career path that you ended up in a PhD? And maybe even if you already know what you're going to do in the future.
Awesome. So yeah, so I grew up in Brampton, Ontario, which is 40 minutes away from the University of Guelph. And I did my undergrad in biological sciences with a minor in business. And throughout my undergrad, I was just really passionate about nutrition. I think I took nutrition courses in almost every species at the university. And that's where I stumbled upon Dr. Shoveler's pet nutrition course. And I originally came to Guelph, I think like a lot of other people, hoping to go to the Ontario Veterinary College. But after taking Dr. Shoveler's pet nutrition course, I quickly realized that there was a lot, you know, I don't know. So I thought, why not do a master's in this? I think it'll give me a good foundation as a veterinarian. So I did try to do a 1 year master's by coursework with Dr. Shoveler. I think within a month I was offered a thesis and took that on. And so my thesis was looking at the safety of pulse ingredients in canine diets. And we'll be talking about that a lot today. And then moving into my PhD now, I'm just looking at protein quality metrics in pet food, which I'm really excited about as well.
Great. So why pulses? You know, tell us a little bit why pulses are now considered food ingredients. We're going to go a little bit afterwards the concerns that have been raised over the last few years. But in general, what is the benefit of pulses as food ingredients?
Pulse ingredients are looked at like beneficial ingredients in human nutrition and in pet food. So they are low in fat and high in fiber. So a lot of people see them as beneficial for promoting satiety. They're used in weight loss diets. They have a low glycemic index, so they help regulate. They help with diets to help with diabetes. And they have a good protein profile for a plant protein. So they're often used in plant-based diets as a protein source. And then kind of moving into this field in pet nutrition, they're also used as carbohydrate sources in grain-free diets as well.
So how long, since when have they been used? When is the time when it went into pet nutrition?
I would say that pulses have been used in pet food for decades. I think more so recently with this increase in grain-free diets in the past, I want to say maybe 6-7 years, that grain-free diets have kind of been increasing in popularity. The use of pulses has also increased. But I think they've been an ingredient used in pet food for forever, I would say.
For more than 20 years, Biorigin manufactures high-quality yeast-based ingredients through a sustainable biotechnological process, guaranteeing full traceability from the crop to the bowl. Through specialization in the fermentation process, BioOrigin brings the right solution for specific nutritional, palatability, and health appeals, such as gut health, immune system, skin health, weight control, and more. BioOrigin's products are natural origin, non-GMO, and certified sustainable by Bonsucro. BioOrigin is your partner for high-quality, yeast-based ingredients to add value to pet foods worldwide. Learn more at BioOrigin.net.
So for the pet food itself, is it an easy process to incorporate them, pulses instead of carbohydrates? Or tell me a little bit more. I'm not a nutritionist, so I'm coming from the GI side. So whatever we can tell us a little bit, the processing and, you know, the ease of it, the reproducibility and quality conditions. I'm just curious about all of this.
Yeah. So in pulses, similar to how humans consume them, pulses have to be heat and pressure treated, just because pulses have a lot of anti-nutritional factors. And so by cooking them, essentially, we reduce these anti-nutritional factors. It improves their digestibility. It improves their taste. And so in pet food, at least, a lot of pet food is extruded. So the ease of incorporating pulse ingredients, I would say, is there. Extrusion has been around for decades. And I think using pulses in that sense hasn't been difficult. I would say oftentimes pulses have been used in combination with grain ingredients or other ingredients. I think that as a protein source, they're also, I don't want to put this out there, maybe cheaper than an animal source and more sustainable to grow. So they're a great sustainable source of protein. They have very much environmental benefits, I would say, in terms of cultivating them. So, kind of pros all around in that sense. They're cheaper, they're a good protein source. They're generally accepted by dogs and cats. So,
potentially negative, you know, attributes, not necessarily for health, but just from a processing question. Is there anything that it would be more challenging to do compared to other ingredients?
I'm by no means a processing expert, but I think when it comes to pulse ingredients, when we're cooking them, we're trying to remove these anti-nutritional factors. But we also, you want to be mindful of other ingredients like the protein content and stuff. So I think that's kind of on the extruders, where they've kind of mastered being able to cook things effectively to reduce anti-nutritional factors, but not, I would say, quote unquote, like damage the protein, the fat, and the other minerals and stuff.
But cooking and heating is very essential.
Yeah, for pulse ingredients, they have to be heat and pressure cooked, I think, in order to kind of reap the benefits of pulse ingredients.
And what are, so you mentioned already some health benefits, right, as an addition, but are there additional health benefits or immune system, other things that has been studied beyond just nutritional values?
I think with pulse ingredients, like I mentioned, the fiber content. So they're often looked at for gut health, prebiotics, things like that. I think they're used for, in terms of like health overall that I haven't talked about, like the fiber content, again, is kind of the winning point there. So they're used to help lower cholesterol. They're seen to have cardiometabolic benefits. A lot of that research is done in human nutrition, but yeah.
So tell us a little bit about your master's and why your master's project, you know, what you did and actually why you did it. What were the controversies in the beginning and what was ultimately your conclusions of your study?
When I started my master's, it was in 2020. And in 2018, the FDA, you know, released this statement, kind of speculating this association between grain-free pulse-inclusive diets and the development of dilated cardiomyopathy in healthy dogs. And this was because pulse ingredients, while they are a great source of protein, they have their amino acid composition. They are lower in the sulfur amino acids, which is actually doesn't meet the physiological requirements outlined for dogs. So they're deficient in the sulfur amino acids. And methionine and cysteine are precursors to an amino acid called taurine. And taurine is highly concentrated in the heart and helps with cardiac function. So kind of this speculation that the low methionine leads to a taurine deficiency, which can lead to dilated cardiomyopathy, which I'm going to start calling DCM because it's very long. And taurine deficient DCM is known to be reversible, but a taurine deficiency is also known to be a cause of DCM. So it's kind of speculated that pulses are, you know, kind of doing this. And so a lot of clinical studies were happening where dogs who had DCM were being studied and trying, there was like retrospective studies to see what they were eating, to see if it was the cause of DCM. However, in these clinical studies, the cause of DCM was unknown. A lot of these dogs, while they were given a diet change, so a lot of them started with a grain-free diet, they were changed onto a grain-based diet. But at the same time, a lot of them had congestive heart failure. A lot of them were put onto cardiac medications. But a lot of the, I guess, beneficial improvements were being attributed to the diets, which is difficult to say because of the fact that there is medication involved and the presence of disease.
So just to verify, so you mean the diet improvement was because they were moved from a grain-free diet to a regular diet?
That's what they were attributing the improvements in cardiac condition to. However, in these studies, there were dogs that started off on a grain-based diet, but then just switched onto another grain-based diet. But the conclusions being made were in regards to pulses, which I think is difficult because any of these retrospective studies can help us maybe uncover relationships or correlations rather than causation. And then a couple years later, it kind of moved into retrospective studies using healthy dogs. So we would do, again, retrospective diet analysis and assessment using cardiac biomarkers in the dogs to see if there's an association between a grain-based diet or a grain-free pulse-inclusive diet. But again, like the diets range so much in formulation and ingredients and macronutrients. So again, it's difficult to say that anything that we're seeing potentially could be because of pulse ingredients alone. And that's kind of what led me into my master's study, where we've investigated the inclusion of 0% pulses to 45% inclusion of pulse ingredients in canine diets. And we fed a combination of pulse ingredients to healthy Siberian Husky dogs for 20 weeks. And we chose Huskies because we wanted to choose a dog that wasn't genetically predisposed to any cardiac disease, and dogs that were in the same environment as well, because these are potential factors that can contribute to the development of the disease. So we wanted to control for all those. And yeah, we fed these diets for 20 weeks and we did echocardiogram assessments. We looked at cardiac biomarkers like cardiac troponin I, NT-proBNP. We also looked at body composition to see if there was some sort of limitation with protein synthesis due to the amino acid composition of pulses. We looked at sulfur amino acid status. We looked at taurine status, and then overt like measurements of health, like complete blood count and biochemistry panels as well.
And so what were your results? You can tell us, we have plenty of time.
So after 20 weeks, we didn't see any changes in cardiac or any negative changes in the echocardiographic parameters, the cardiac biomarkers or DEXA or CBC and biochemistry. So we concluded that pulse ingredients were safe to include, but also we are considered to the fact that all of our diets, we tried to make them mimic commercial diets. So we used ingredients that are commonly used, similar to commercial diets. All of our diets exceeded the like AFCO nutrient requirements. We also to try to keep things as controlled as possible to be able to make conclusions about the pulse ingredients alone. All of the diets had the exact same ingredients, had the same micronutrient supplementation. And yeah, I think we tried to control everything that we could. We tried to feed to maintain baseline body weight as well. Because in some of the other diets or other studies, you would see supplementation of amino acids or diets that didn't meet nutrient requirements. So we really did not want to study the effects of a nutrient deficiency. We wanted to have diets that meet nutrient requirements to see if the pulse ingredients themselves, like the presence of them in the diets, were causing any negative impacts on canine health.
And so clinical students, they're mostly clinical. There was no clinical science, no CPC serum. What about amino acids you mentioned, but can you maybe expand more, like taurine and other I mean, I did it not change at all?
Yeah. So in the, I fasted, we saw no differences in any of the, I mean, the sulfur amino acids or taurine, and all of the taurine concentrations were way above what is considered deficient in dogs. And then we also did postprandial blood collection to see. And in that, we did see that postprandially, the corn or like grain-based diet had higher methionine concentrations, or dogs that were consuming that diet had greater postprandial methionine concentration compared to the other dogs. But there were no differences in taurine or cysteine in that regard. But the methionine, also the corn diets themselves had more methionine due to the corn gluten meal. So it naturally, it's just a reflection, I think, of the diet having more methionine.
Are you planning, or did you plan also look at other things like microbiome, some other, you know, metabolites and so on? Or is it something for the future?
With these diets, we tried to do a comprehensive study. We looked at a bunch of things. And I'm currently looking at the fecal metabolites and bile acid composition, largely because that was a main concern with taurine status, that increased bile acid excretion may impact taurine status. So everything that's been published till now, we didn't see any changes in taurine status. In other literature with dogs and pulse ingredients, we see that there are some studies that say that bile acid excretion does increase with the presence of pulse ingredients, but taurine status doesn't change. So kind of that last missing piece of this project that I'm working on right now is looking at the bile acids and fecal metabolites. And I can kind of speak on that now, but we didn't see any changes overall on the bile acids. We did see some greater excretion of secondary bile acids actually from the corn-based diet in comparison to the grain-free diets, interestingly enough, but no overall changes to the primary or secondary bile acids or total bile acid excretion. And with the fecal metabolites, I think as we expected, we did see greater production of the short-chain fatty acids with the increase with the presence of the fiber of the pulse ingredients. And we also saw greater monosaccharides. But there was also with our diets, there's an overall trend for all of the diets to have greater short chain fatty acids and greater monosaccharides. So,
did you also have a chance, or did you consider looking at the serum bile acids, looking at the conjugated portion? Because they sometimes stay a little bit different.
In hindsight now, as I'm analyzing this data, I wish we also looked at it in the blood. But the literature at the time that the study was designed, everyone was looking at it in the fecal metabolites. So I think we tried to slip that in to kind of create this big picture. But if I could go back reading the literature now, I think looking at it in the blood would be very beneficial.
So how does your results pretty much match with other literature? I mean, are they consistent? Because you said you had a diet that is kind of controlled for, right? You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, is there potential that other diet formats, I mean, are all the pulse diets, are they all extruded? Are there some other diets, or is pulse sometimes added to non-extruded diets? Maybe there's some other, you know, maybe that's not the ingredient, but the way it's processed and so on. Are you aware of?
I think that's a big consideration moving forward. I think the literature at the time that the study was done, especially with everything leading up to kind of what I've done so far, have been commercial kibble, like extruded diets. But my study was the first long-term, like controlled feeding trial. So it was really hard to compare it to anything that was done. There are a couple of new studies after mine. They also use extruded kibble diets. So again, the processing implications are there. But like you mentioned, like there are how long you cook it, how you cook it, the temperature, the pressure, the interaction with different ingredients, I think are things that we haven't considered yet or we haven't fully looked into, but they do play a really big role in nutrient provision of the entire diet. And as you mentioned, these raw diets or these fresh diets, I'm not sure. I don't anticipate, or I can't imagine someone taking dried lentils and adding it to their dog's diet. Because I think oftentimes when even we eat pulse ingredients, you know, use a pressure cooker, it's just kind of how you do it. But I'm not sure. I think processing is vital to be able to reap the benefits of pulse ingredients, you know, remove these anti-nutritional factors, make them more digestible. So I'm not sure. I think that's something to consider. And maybe as we navigate more towards these more raw diets or fresh diets is something that will be looked into, because I think it's important for people who maybe want to include these pulse ingredients as a carb source to have a better understanding of how to prepare them for their dog.
Maybe a brief anecdote. I used a vegan shake recently. It also has pulses a lot, right?
Yeah.
And it's actually, I don't know how they produce it, how they cook it, it's, but in the end, it's very, very, how to call it, not dissolvable. You kind of shake it, but you wait for 5 seconds. Everything, you know, top stuff. So there's definitely also preparation is obviously an important factor to consider.
Yeah.
So what do you see now this topic going, right? I mean, obviously, there was a lot of, you know, a lot of publicity about the potential negative effects on pulses, right? Now, studies show that it may be, you know, it may be safe and so on. So how do you see the field moving, or what other research do you think is needed that we better understand the pulses and then, you know?
So I think I mentioned it, but the FDA did release a statement basically at the time that my study was ending, saying like, there's not enough research, we're not going to say anything more here about pulse ingredients. But I think that initial statement really left a mark and really makes people worried. And, you know, when you talk to veterinarians now, a lot of them kind of divert from grain-free diets because they don't want to, you know, maybe recommend a diet that could cause a potential issue. So I think there is still this, maybe this fear, maybe now this like reputation that grain-free diets may have. But people use grain-free diets for multiple reasons, like, oh, my dog has allergies, my dog, you know, I don't think my dog should have grain. So there's multiple reasons why pulse ingredients, I think, are used. And I think to move forward, I think research just about the digestibility and the amino acid composition of different pulse ingredients really helps. At least from the formulation side, it gives you a lot more confidence on maybe how to use an ingredient. But as you've mentioned, processing is something that should always be considered. Like in these papers, like processing will change potentially the bioavailability, digestibility. So I think just more research maybe on different ingredients, but also different processing methods perhaps will help create this confidence in using these ingredients. I think clinically, I think while my study showed that this specific combination of pulse ingredients that exceeded AFCO requirements with all these micronutrients, we didn't see anything. I think maybe looking at studies with perhaps a different combination of pulse ingredients, or maybe more isolated pulse ingredients that are more commonly used, and maybe with diets that just meet nutrient requirements rather than exceed them, I think will also help, because not all diets, you know, exceed AFCO requirements by 60%. I think a lot of on the market they do. But I think maybe, you know, experimenting with different diets that exist commercially will help. I think continuing to use healthy dogs and dogs of different breed sizes, because dogs of large breed dogs and small breed dogs have different taurine biosynthesis rates, different methionine concentrations, and they're predisposed to different health impacts. So I think, you know, it's long. I think it's hard when you have all these different breeds and all these things to consider, but I think creating more controlled studies, but accounting for a larger, I would say maybe population, will really help continue to build the confidence in using pulse ingredients, because they are a great source of like sustainable alternative proteins, great source of fiber, and like they have a lot of health benefits. So I think if we can continue to, you know, have research to back up these benefits, at least in dogs, because there is a lot in human nutrition, I think continuing to do so in dog diets, I think, will be really beneficial.
It's time for our famous three.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
ICC Animal Nutrition, adding value to nutrition. Trow Nutrition, the science of ingredients, nutrition, and blending. Kemin Nutrisurance is your pet food and rendering partner every step of the way. Trusted ingredients, proven performance, Wilbur Ellis Nutrition. We partner with a purpose. Kemin Nutrisurance is compelled to provide safe and delicious ingredients to improve our pets' food so they can have the best quality of life. Every day, they deliver specialized expertise, innovative products, and unrivaled support through the pet food and rendering value chain. From oxidation control and food safety to palatability and nutrition, all the way through a suite of tailored services that support you from start to finish, we ensure you're getting the most from Kemin ingredients. Kemin is compelled by curiosity to ensure pets around the world are living happy and healthy lives.
So we're almost at the end, Pan. Thank you so much. I have a question, so maybe like a few last 1 or 2 minutes. So you're doing, what is your PhD now? So you said you're doing a protein matrix, correct? Can you tell us just maybe 1 or 2 minutes what it means and where you see this going? Why is it important?
Yeah, so protein, I think, is probably the most sought after macronutrient. It's the most expensive ingredient when we look at our diets, our dog's diets. But I think this idea of what is a good quality protein, you know, it's kind of up in the air. No one can really define what is a good quality protein. And especially when it comes to our dog diets, we largely formulate diets for our dogs. We usually give them one type of diet for a long period of time. And so it's just to kind of standardize protein quality metrics in pet food. I think that will help with formulation, but I think it will also help with, you know, consumer insights on, okay, this is good for my dog, this isn't good for my dog. And so the first study that I've done so far, I haven't analyzed my data yet, but it was a survey looking at protein perspectives and knowledge and perspectives of different protein sources or protein quality in dog food. And I surveyed dog owners, veterinarians, dog breeders, pet store employees to kind of see where we are. What is the general understanding of what is good quality protein in dog food? What are ingredients that people accept? And I think having the professionals like the veterinarians and the dog owners will be really cool to see, you know, do these ideas kind of translate from one another? And I think they will. I think, you know, when you think about dog food, people oftentimes go to their veterinarian, they'll go online, they'll go to their dog breeder. So I'm really excited to see that, to see where kind of the perspectives lay. And I think understanding what people know and what they think about certain protein sources really helps the pet food industry navigate. Now we can understand, okay, where does more education kind of need to be given? What types of ingredients should we even be using? Because will dog owners, you know, accept this or not? And it also helps us understand moving towards, like, I guess, ingredient sustainability, like maybe what novel sources we can use to mitigate this, like, protein demand that's, you know, we share ingredients with our dogs. We want to make sure that all of us get good quality nutrients and meet our nutrient requirements. So I think it helps us navigate understanding the use of ingredients in the future, like alternatives that we may be able to incorporate into dog food as well.
It's very exciting. I think we need to invite you back once you have the results of your survey.
Yeah, that will be really cool.
And you can report. That will be a very, very interesting topic for everyone. Great. Thank you so much, Pawan. And so this concludes another episode of the Pet Food Science Podcast, presented to you by Wisenetics. Thank you for joining us today. Don't forget to subscribe so you stay updated on future episodes. If you please leave us a review and get us a feedback so we know how you like those topics. And so until next time, my name is Jan Spedalski, and I'm tuning off from the Pet Food Science Podcast. Bye-bye.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.